You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show. There's at least one person out there still willing to buy a newspaper. The Los Angeles Times finds a buyer amid an encouraging week for proper grown-up media. My guests Chiara Ramella, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the beginning of the Pyeongchang Winter Games and the beginning of weeks of beard-scratching rune-reading vis-a-vis what it tells us about the relationship between the two Koreas, the premiere of Black Panther and whether it's likely to be as good as it is significant and how much that even matters, and is a museum about climate change going to tempt visitors away from the Empire State Building and the Statue of Liberty? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome all to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Chiara Ramella, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Welcome all. And first of all, though it is legendarily difficult to persuade members of the media to talk about the media, we are famously abstemious, self-effacing people. We will start tonight by talking about the media, especially as this week has furnished some good and or encouraging media news, which is not something we get to say all the time. The Los Angeles Times has found a buyer who appears interested in actually owning a newspaper, the New York Times continues to rack up subscriptions, and a Brazilian daily is planning to defy the Facebook hegemon. Henry, first of all, Patrick Soon-Shiong has bought the Los Angeles Times. I don't know what it tells us that these days when a billionaire buys a newspaper, everyone goes, hooray! Whereas 20 or 30 years ago, everyone was like, oh no, a billionaire's bought a newspaper.
But haven't most newspapers been owned by billionaires of one cast or another throughout
history?
Rarely
are they purchased from somebody from the wrong side of the tracks with a printing press and a dream.
It's true. I think the particular, I wouldn't say joy, but optimism, cautious optimism that has greeted this purchase does have to do with the fact that the LA Times has been going through a bit of a rocky patch recently.
It has.
And so it's within that context that I think Soon-Shiong is viewed as a potential steady hand grasping hold of the tiller, at least financially. But a lot of the turbulence has had to do with the changeover on the editorial side of things. And I think the relationship, obviously, between the two different sides is going to count for a lot shaping the times to come.
Fernando, is there something the Los Angeles Times, he said, linking us seamlessly to the next subject, can learn from the New York Times? Because the New York Times, there was sort of clouds circling it or perceived to be a few years ago, but it has in the last 2 years gone from strength to strength, at least digitally. Another 157,000 digital subscribers in the last quarter of 2017, share price up and so forth. Have they it seems weird to describe the election of Donald Trump to the presidency as anybody getting lucky, but has that actually worked really well for the Times? Is this the Trump effect?
Well, yes, and not only Trump, but, you know, I think something that we would discuss in a bit, Harvey Weinstein stories as well. I think it did help to increase the circulation and the subscription revenues for the New York Times. And I think that's what's kind of missing at the Los Angeles Times, in my opinion, to have a story they can call its own in a way. And I think they have a problem with branding and perhaps, you know, with more, you know, more money getting invested into the business, because come on, they're based in Los Angeles, which is, you know, doing well as a city and attracting a lot of different business. I think it's important to have a very strong business there in the West Coast in America. So there's certainly a lot of potential there, and I don't think they are doing their best at the moment. So I kind of welcome those news. And you know, looking at the history of Patrick Soon-Shiong, I mean, I'm not an expert on him, but I think he seems quite a decent person. And I think if it's a decent billionaire, I don't mind.
I do agree with the fact that there is a dearth of, I think, big US media voices from the West Coast, because one of the things that was mentioned in the LA Times own piece about being bought out was the fact that it kind of not resented, but obviously admitted the fact that its competitors on the East Coast were better funded and therefore also better heard around the country and beyond. And I think there is an opportunity there for a Californian news narrative to be born as well, because so much of the East Coast narrative is naturally and inevitably shaped by Washington. I wonder if there is space for the alternative Californian narrative to come to the fore, especially because also in itself, it's also a bit of an anti-Trump narrative. So I look forward to that.
Kiara, are you surprised that the Harvey Weinstein story is being credited in no small part as the reason for the latest bump by the New York Times? I mean, I guess to an extent, it's sort of an extension of the Donald Trump story, because in the same way that the election or the ascent of Donald Trump did inadvertently, from his point of view, push a lot of women's issues related to women into the mainstream narrative, the Harvey Weinstein story seems to have taken that still further.
I think so, but I don't think it's just an issue of content. Obviously, the Weinstein story is very relevant, and I think it's important that it came out. But I think it's the fact that finally, as Fernando was mentioning earlier, a paper can claim a story as its own. I'm thinking about, for example, when The Guardian just became the paper that did the Snowden story. I think there's something to be said about publications that take the time and care and effort to actually still be the papers that break these stories and that own them completely.
In the same way that the Financial Times got that bump the other week from being the paper that did the President's Club story.
Well, I think so. I think it's just important that it is recognised there are certain papers that are still willing to take a chance into doing things their own and breaking exclusives, because ultimately that's what genuinely drives the narrative forward.
I think there's a temptation and possibly an even stronger bias on the part of people who are in the news media and like news to think that exceptional news coverage is the main thing driving increased success when it comes to legacy newspaper brands and media brands. But I think it is worth pointing out that one of the big causes of the jump in subscriptions last year in the New York Times is that they basically connected access to their recipes pages and the crosswords to subscription membership. And that was seen to be a very strong driver. And I do think it's worth pointing out that when it comes to lots of legacy media brands, they have been expanding into more what would previously be considered lifestyle areas very successfully recently. And I think part of the reluctance, that there may be a reluctance on the part of readers of these brands and followers of these brands to admit that this stuff interests them too.
But it's
and
also,
that's why it's not spoken about as much.
I mean, it's also a reluctance on the part of journalists. As you were saying, we like the big, serious, grown-up stories, but we have to deal with the fact that a skateboarding parrot is basically going to blow any of our most learned efforts out of the water. Fernando, just a final thought on our brisk media wrap-up. Your hometown newspaper, or one of your hometown newspapers, is bailing on Facebook. Why?
Well, I actually welcome those news. So basically, Facebook had a change in their algorithm. So basically, they're giving more attention to personal posts instead of posts from traditional media or news organizations. So Folha de São Paulo said, you know what, we don't want to be part of that. So we're going to pull out our content from the social media website. And they have a strong website themselves, like the New York Times. So in fact, they kind of don't need Facebook. So I think it was quite brave. It's not that they're pulling out completely. They will still have a page there, but it's just not going to publish any news. And you can still share, for example, if you're reading a Folha de São Paulo article, you can still share it on Facebook. And they said this new algorithm would just encourage fake news. And to be honest, I think I would welcome if more media would do that in a way.
Well, let's look now towards Pyeongchang, where the 2018 Winter Olympics launched today with an opening ceremony, which was a crashing disappointment to those of us who prefer our sporting events to begin with amateurish, ill-choreographed, crass and shambolic hubris, which is to say it was splendidly well done. Congratulations, Pyeongchang. This Winter Olympics will, of course, provide the usual joy of permitting viewers to become instant authorities on sports they know nothing about and may never even have heard of, but also has an unusually intriguing political subtext. Kiara, we did see US Vice President Mike Pence skipping the dinner at which he was due to meet Kim Jong-nam, North Korea's ceremonial head of state. I thought Mike Pence was against using sporting events as a means of political protest, but there we have it.
I guess the irony of it all. Well, I mean, he didn't use it as a means of protest, did he? He just kind of stood in a corner looking a little bit sullen and sulky. He didn't exactly drop to the knees. But all the same, I think that his behaviour is coherent. I'm not particularly surprised by the fact that he decided not to attend. I know that now that the handshake between the two Koreas has happened, we perhaps have come to expect that everybody would come together in a unified demonstration of peace. But I think we need to hold our horses and remember that there is still a subtext that's not quite so much of a subtext at all.
I am hoping at least once at this Games we get the thing where the North Koreans win a medal and they run up the wrong Korean flag, though that's probably less likely at this Games than at most. But that is always a joyous moment. Certainly I, for one, prefer to think that gets done mostly on purpose. I mean, this is, you know, a rhetorical question. Is anything at any Winter Olympic Games ever going to be as good as Stephen Bradbury's gold medal for Australia in 2002? He was, of course, the 1,000-metre fast speed track skater who won when everybody else fell over at the last corner. It's the best thing that's ever happened.
I hadn't seen this before you showed me
it's
earlier.
Glorious.
And it really is the whole human carnival in a 10-second clip, isn't it? Everything's there, the full spectrum of emotions and experience. I would point listeners towards it. No, I don't think we can anticipate anything as good as that. Although most of the sports are fun, aren't they, to watch?
I admit I speak as one of those people who will watch more or less any sporting event, but I do really, really enjoy the Winter Olympics.
I like the exoticism of it. For me, it's like a lot of fluffy sports. As a known expert,
I like the immense painful accidents.
It happens, because especially skeleton and bobsleigh, it's very dangerous.
It does combine kind of ridiculousness with extremely high physical stakes in a way which is, frankly, just raw clickbait, isn't it? For most people, I think.
It's marvellous. Are we all, and I will start on my right-hand side of the table, are we excited about our national team's prospects? Chiara and Italy?
Absolutely. I think it is time for Italy to make a comeback, because last time in Sochi, we didn't do so well, only got 8 medals, no goals, we haven't got a gold in 8 years. And, you know, I know that Italy does well in Summer Olympics as well, but we do have the Alps. We are pretty good skiers. And especially, I'm particularly pinning my hopes on Carolina Kostner, because she's now a 31-year-old figure skater, always kind of on the podium. She's actually collected a record in appearances on podiums throughout her career as a figure skater. But she never quite makes it, because she is one of the ones that actually falls during a competition. She's one of the ones that gives away the victory to the other people.
So Andrew's favourite category.
Absolutely.
Is 31 quite late career for a figure skater?
I mean, I'm no figure skater myself, okay. But I would expect if I were to take up figure skating now, I'd probably be considered a bit of a latecomer.
That's not
party.
An answer to my question, but it's probably a factually correct statement.
But Henry, Team GB, are you excited? Have you been pinning up your national flag and painting your face and waiting for it all to start?
No more than usual, because the Winter Olympics are on. I'm not following Team GB particularly. Curling is obviously the kind of great... It's the great totemic comedy Winter Olympic sport. And as far as I can tell, only Alaskans, Canadians and Scottish people do it. So I think we're always in the running for a podium position in that sport. I'll probably watch a highlight clip of the best curling shots at the end. And I think that will sate my appetite for the Winter Olympics.
See, I try really hard not to join in with the sneering at obscure sports, especially during the Summer Games, where there's a lot of it about, you know, synchronised swimming and things of that ilk. Curling is the one that does make me suspect that pretty much anybody who could be bothered could probably do okay at this.
Yeah, it's difficult to imagine that the talent pool is broad and deep enough to actually kind of exclude, for example, anyone who has a go at it. But I think that makes it all the more colourful and worth watching, personally.
Speaking of talent, I think we need to make a mention, of the shirtless Tongan who made headlines during the opening ceremony.
You don't know his name, do you?
I do.
Okay,
I'm going to pronounce it right now. It's Peter Taufa Totua.
Okay.
Well done.
And he's
yes.
192 and 100 kilos.
Thank you.
That's the detail that Fernando cares about.
You see how assiduously, listeners, our panel have been researching their subjects, especially the shirtless Tongan. Chiara, he became something of an instant global superstar at the opening ceremony of the Summer Games.
Yes, for being shirtless.
So he is clearly a multi-talented athlete. He is now in his national Winter Olympic team as well.
What I love is that exactly he competed in Taekwondo in Rio and now
he won a medal,
yes, and now was swapped for cross country skiing.
Spoiler alert, he's not going to win a medal at that.
It's the easiest sport for a non-traditional in wintry countries. We're sending some people for this category.
Tonga as a non-traditional Winter Olympic country. That is the understatement of the century.
Took up the sport, I think it's worth mentioning too, in 2016. Which I think just adds another.
When we say he is representing Tonga in cross-country skiing at the Winter Olympics, what we basically mean is that he is a Tongan citizen who owns a pair of skis.
Essentially, yes.
That's how he got the job.
He did appear in the identical straw skirt and no top. That has become his calling card, didn't he?
Which is particularly surprising because this edition of the Games is said to be a particularly cold one. Fernando was saying earlier, the US athletes actually arrived onto the stage wearing battery-powered heated jackets designed by Ralph Lauren. Yes.
He's doing so much for Tonga's soft power, in a way.
Well, yes. Fernando, very briefly, your assessment of Brazil's chances.
Yeah, I think they're not very good. We never won a medal in the Winter Olympics, but if I have any hopes, it would be with snowboarder Isabel Clark. In fact, she was in the 2006 Winter Olympics in Turin, and she was ninth. So that's the closest we ever got of a medal.
Are we meant to be impressed by that?
Yes.
Okay. So if six people fall over, she's in business.
She got a bronze.
Okay, we're going on that hopeful note to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Henry Rees Sheridan and Chiara Ramella. Coming up next, our panel excitedly discuss a movie none of us have seen.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Chiara Ramella and Henry Rees Sheridan. Last night in London saw the premiere of the much ballyhooed blockbuster Black Panther. None of us were invited. The film is distinguished from your run-of-the-mill high-octane superhero nonsense by the fact that for the first time a major film of this type has a predominantly black cast and a black lead character. Fernando, it is 2018. It's kind of weird, is it not, that this hasn't happened before?
It is very weird. I mean, it kind of happened before, but in smaller films, like, for example, Blade with Wesley Snipes in 98.
Fair
but
point.
I don't think it counts because it was not as mainstream as this one. And I think it's quite sad, but apparently the bosses of Hollywood studios say that the films might do well in America, but they don't sell abroad. But to be honest, I kind of don't believe in it, you know. And they say, you know, if a person has a black lead, look at the success of Will Smith, for example. He might do well in Brazil, he might do well in China. So I think it's completely wrong. And I have to say, Andrew, I'm not a superhero film fan, but I'm excited to see the Black Panther because I can understand, you know, especially kids that they don't see themselves represented. You know, I'm not talking here about indie films. I'm talking about proper mainstream heroes like Thor, you know, Superman, Batman. And apparently the reviews have been excellent as well.
But you think that kind of representation is important?
I think it is important. Very important. And the problem is, when films like this happen, there's so much pressure for the film to be excellent. Because then, if this doesn't do well, it's like, oh, see, a film with a black lead will not sell abroad.
And Chiara, is the real test going to be really whether there's now a second and third and fourth and fifth and so on film of this type featuring a black cast and black lead characters.
I think so. I mean, when you think about the mirroring issue, which is superhero films with women leads, we saw it a little bit with Wonder Woman, where you kind of have that character. That's it done. That kind of ticks the box for representation of women, and then we can go back to doing all the rest of the films without women leads again. Now, I'm fairly pleased because I think there's a film coming out about Black Widow, which is going to be interpreted by Scarlett Johansson. And I think that bodes really well because she's already done really well as a strong female lead on her own in Ghost in the Shell, for example, in similar roles. So maybe by way of her strength in being able to pull people behind her, if Black Widow was to do really well as well, then it could lead to a more credible kind of strain of films that have strong female leads. So yes, I do think that the strength is in the numbers, and that one is just not enough, because otherwise it's just box ticking.
There is a weird thing though, Henry, and to my mind it is actually one of the great joys of the diversifying of what can be thought of as a lead film character, that there is a cohort of people who get incredibly, like, genuinely angry. The people who got upset by a female remake of Ghostbusters, and the people who get really outraged when anyone suggests that maybe a black guy could play James Bond. It is one of the strangest social media phenomena there is.
I think they're racist and sexist, right? I don't think I have a wittier response to it than that.
No, I suspect if we went looking for a more
nuanced
explanation, we might struggle.
Yeah, I think so. I don't really want to have a stab at that. I do think it's worth just acknowledging that. I think it's easy to be kind of sneery or dismissive of pop culture, big Hollywood or mainstream pop culture artifacts, which, you know, purport to kind of like bring with them sweeping social change, etc., etc., because, you know, it's there's a temptation to think about them as being superficial or too commercial to actually be radicalized. But I think you can never underestimate that, like, at the end of the day, a film which, for example, has a disproportionate amount or a proportionate amount of black or female representation in comparison to mainstream or the norm or normal films so far, ultimately they are seen by and emotionally connected with by far more people than people who will ever, for example, read a well thought through progressive op-ed in a broadsheet newspaper or engage with some kind of academic article or BBC Four documentary about similar issues. That's just a fact, and ultimately they probably are greater engines of change in the long run for that reason.
I think there's a lot of riding on these things as well, when you think about the fact that then you really must make sure that everything, just by way of the fact that it is commercialized and popularized, doesn't necessarily take the shortcut and is still to the highest level of kind of proper representation. I know that, Andrew, you may believe that perhaps there is a bit of an overreaction to the ensuring that everything is safely represented and not stereotypically represented.
I don't think it's an overreaction. I think it's understandable. It's just that I get confused by... It seems to me that a lot of people now, well, when I say a lot of people, possibly just the more voluble ones, consume art, not just film, but books and music and television, as something that they need to approve of rather than enjoy.
Yes, it's true, but I think it is because there's so much riding on these things that we just can't afford not having a critical eye anymore. Maybe I'm just being boring, but I just can't help it.
But to be fair, with the Black Panther, I mean, as you very correctly said, none of us have seen it. But, you know, apparently, you know, the script is excellent, the acting is good.
The reviews have been really good.
So, you know what I mean? I kind of, of course, I want to enjoy. I don't think it should only be approved. But I think with this film in particular, everything has been excellent. So, you know, I think that's not one of those cases.
Yeah, sorry. I think I just want to say before we move on, Martin Freeman, who's one of the actors, British actor in the film, a white actor, I should say, has said in an interview I watched earlier, just, you know, we didn't want to be part, the cast didn't want to be part of a kind of dry information, kind of almost like public information leaflet, kind of going out there and purporting to do good things and to be representative. They want to be part of an entertaining film. And ultimately, I do think that that is the kind of best Trojan horse mechanism for actually affecting changes of hearts and minds in society now, to be honest. It is pop culture is the North Star by which we navigate our social context.
Well, finally tonight, we will go to New York and the tentative launch of what may yet prove to be the world's most boring museum. The Parsons School of Design has unveiled a limited installation intended to become the foundation of the world's first climate change museum. Is there any way that it can avoid becoming, much like the subject itself, obviously really important, because obviously it is, yet incredibly tedious? Fernando, if you had a limited amount of time in New York, would you be taking time? I mean, the thing is, it's got a lot of competition, is my point.
It does. And actually, I need to go to New York soon. But to be honest, I am not super tempted to go. But I think if they wanted to go, I mean, I hope they have some good exhibitions there. And
do you know, I can't believe you've just defined it boring, because I don't see how the apocalypse can ever appear boring.
But if they'd said the Museum of the Impending Apocalypse, then I'm buying a ticket for that all day.
That's just a byword. Climate change is byword for we're all just going to... Yeah, never mind. Well, just want to just gloss over that.
They should rebrand, is what we're saying.
Yeah, I think so.
And clearly hire Chiara as the creative director.
Definitely.
I'll take marketing director.
What kind of exhibits do you think that they should be having then? Should there be a virtual reality room where you have to wrestle with your fellow survivors for the last remaining rat?
Sorry, Chiara, you answered that, but actually, there was a similar exercise actually in Australia, Andrew. You will be familiar with this. It was the VR forest fires experience that was released by the, I think, Victoria, if I'm correct. Please, did you see this?
I unaccountably did not.
So basically, the police force in a part of Australia that's very prone to forest fires released basically what you just described, a VR experience where you inhabit the perspective of someone whose house is being slowly encroached upon by forest fires, and you have to make a series of decisions, I think almost all of which lead to your sure death. And it's meant to be a public educational resource. That could work.
Exactly, that sounds amazing.
Might book the technology. Now, I think even something quite as simple as something I remember seeing as a child, which was a picture of Venice now and a picture of Venice in, say, I don't know, like 2100 or whatever, which was just Venice, but underneath water with loads of dolphins swimming around. I think that's immediately effective.
But you say that like it's a bad thing.
I was just about to say. With loads of dolphins swimming around and more tourists, inexplicably.
No, what I'm trying to say is that I don't think a museum for climate change is a bad idea, and I don't think it would be boring. However, I do agree with the fact that the people who are going to go are probably going to be people like me, who generally spend about 75% of each of their days thinking about the imminent destruction of our planet.
Sounds great. My concern for this is that it will inevitably turn into a petri dish for the growth of oversimplification and public misunderstanding of science, and will also almost certainly in America become a football to be kicked around by the very many vested interest lobby groups that dictate the parameters of how the debate around climate change emerges in America.
Would you go, Fernando? We never got to the bottom of that. You're going to New York?
If I have a week, I go.
If you have Fernando, yes or no, will you go?
No.
Okay. If you have 2 weeks, a month.
Yes, I go.
Fernando's
2 weeks, I go.
Almost sweating.
Yeah, I'm sweating because I'm quite honest.
That's
on radio. But 2 weeks, I do go. I will go.
Okay. I'm still unpersuaded. I think maybe they should just put it somewhere else. I would name a really boring American city they could put it in, except obviously somebody in that city would be listening to us. And then I just spend the weekend dealing with incredibly angry emails from where it's very... No, I'm not going to say anything. That does bring us, tempting though it is, to the end of today's show. Chiara Ramella, Henry Rhys Sheridan, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, research by Stephanie Sakir. Our studio manager was David Stevens. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. There's more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.